So welcome, everybody. Here we are for our weekly dose of bodhicitta, which we should be reinvigorating every day in ourselves. You know, they say six times a day to remember bodhicitta, but I think especially, this class is what I've noticed is a big antidote to what's going on in the country. And especially when people feel discouraged or afraid or, despair or whatever, bodhicitta is really the antidote to all of that. Yeah, because it expands our mind to see past just this life, and it expands our mind to be concerned for others and to see the good in the world, to see the potential and good in ourselves. And keeping all of that in mind is very, very important. Yeah, not just to look at what's going on in the country that is talked about in the newspapers, because the newspaper, the papers always talk about what isn't going well and what to be afraid of. And as His Holiness told them many years ago, they should report the good things too. So here is Shanti Deva, our newspaper reporter from the 8th century, turning up again in this time, reminding us of the good things in the world and the good things in ourselves. So in the visualization we just did, we have Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We have human beings who are creating negative karma. And we have insects in the animal realm being visualized as human beings. And so that's showing us, on the basis of the mind, we can be in any of those states as ordinary beings. If we create virtue, we can, or we will, be born as human beings or other fortunate rebirths. If we use that rebirth to create negative karma, then we will be reborn as bugs or other unfortunate beings. But if we use that human life to create virtue, we could become bodhisattvas and then Buddhas. So it all depends on how we use our lives. And similarly, for all the other sentient beings, where they are, in terms of human beings, unfortunate rebirths, bodhisattvas, it too depends on how they use their lives. So when either we or they get overwhelmed by afflictions, when the afflictions control our mind instead of our wisdom controlling our mind. Then all of us wind up for the worst. So let's generate strong, joyous effort to really turn our attitudes around and be quite conscientious and not allow the afflictions to take over our minds. And to have compassion for when they do, but not compassion for the afflictions, compassion for ourselves, and compassion for others whose minds are overwhelmed by afflictions, even though they just want happiness and not suffering. And seeing the potential in all of us, may we aspire for full awakening and to lead all beings on the path to full awakening. May this be the motivation for sharing the teachings today. So, in what's been playing out in the country in recent days after the first debate, we see especially with the president's praise of the Proud Boys and other white supremacists, to relate our Dharma practice to that, it shows us an example of the lack of equanimity and how equanimity is so important as the basis for love, compassion, and bodhicitta. Okay? Because if we don't have equanimity, if, you know, we pick out certain beings and favor them and other beings and discriminate against them, then right away we are blocked. Yeah, because how can we have the wish for all of them to be happy if we don't wish all of them to be happy? And how can we wish all of them to be free of suffering if that's really not what we wish? Okay, so I find it very useful to use these examples of what we're seeing in the world around us as analogies to look at my own discrimination. Okay? So you can see in the terms of the white supremacists, yeah, that without any kind of reason that is a reliable cognizer, then, you know, favoring one group and having antipathy towards another group. Okay? So just on the basis of one's own distorted conceptions, one's own inappropriate attention, designating some beings as superior and other ones as inferior. But like I said, with no reliable cognizer lying behind that. Do you agree? Yeah? So that's the same mechanism that our mind uses if we take certain kinds of people. Maybe we do that with the white nationalists, the white supremacists, and we just put them all in a box. They're all like this. Yeah, no variation amongst them. They're all cut out of the same cookie cutter. Therefore, they are all bad. And we create that image, give that name, our distorted conceptions, you know, grasping that they're inherently like that. And then that gives rise to our anger, and we give ourselves permission to discriminate against and hate other living beings who find themselves in that position of having such distorted minds that they don't understand the kind of karma they're creating or the harm they're doing to themselves and to society and to other living beings. So then we become just as blind as they become, because it's the same mechanism of stereotyping with no reliable cognizer behind it and putting everybody in the same box and justifying our own hatred. Yeah. So we have to be very, very careful about this, because it is so easy and so tempting to slip into that. Yeah. And we may think, well, it's a just, we do have a reliable cognizer because these people are prejudiced and they're not seeing the good qualities of others, so they're bad. But we're not realizing that we're exactly the same way. Yeah. So it's really imperative that we watch our own mind quite closely. And we can call out things, behavior, beliefs, things that are damaging, that are not non-virtuous. We can call them out. We need to call them out. We need to speak up. Yeah, but we do this without anger and hatred. That's the key. That's the main point, okay? That getting rid, subduing our anger and hatred doesn't mean we back out of difficult situations, stick our head in the ground, and say, just forget it, I'm going to concentrate on my own life. Yeah. On the other hand, it doesn't mean that we go to the other extreme and neglect our own mind and our own life and generate a mind similar to the people we are protesting against, but just having another group other than that we're prejudiced against, other than the group they're prejudiced against. Okay, so we have to have this balance in our own mind of really working with our own tendency to put people in boxes and dismiss them, and our own tendency to stick our head in the ground and ignore it, and our own tendency, to criticize others. And instead, if we're going to criticize, talk about the beliefs, not the person. So we separate the actions from the person. We separate the beliefs from the person. We can talk about the destructiveness of certain beliefs and certain actions, but without having hatred or criticism for the people who hold them, because we realize that their minds are overwhelmed by afflictions and they have no awareness, no wisdom mind to guide them in this process. Okay, so we may have a little bit of wisdom mind. It's important that we use it. And it's nothing to be proud about on our own part that we are superior to anybody else, because we're all in samsara together. Aren't we? Yeah? So we're all in the same lifeboat together with all the white supremacists. Yeah? And together with, all the terrorists, and together with all the bodhisattvas on the path of accumulation and path of preparation. We're all in this boat together, yeah? So we've got to make peace in our minds with everybody and still hold our moral ground and speak our moral ground. Okay, is this making sense to people? Yeah.
So you mentioned there's no reliable cognizer when we categorize people as certain, entities. So with the white supremacist, it seems that to be a white supremacist, you hold certain beliefs, such as whites are superior and deserve, better. Whereas their kind of thinking, they would say, just take African Americans. African Americans are all such and such. But that's less true, or it seems to be less true, their beliefs are less true than what we would hold about them, because they self-proclaim, these are our views.
Yeah, but we self-proclaim our views are, we want to destroy all these people who have such distorted views. Okay, so this is where it's really important to distinguish the person from their view. Yeah, the view is distorted, the view is harmful, the person has the potential to become fully awakened. Okay, so that's why it's so important we discern the difference between them. Yeah. Otherwise, another group of people could look at us and say, oh, you people talk about love and compassion for all sentient beings, but you're really biased. You hate all the white supremacists. So why do you think you're so good if you're doing exactly what they're doing? And those people would be right. Wouldn't they? If they call out our bigotry, it doesn't matter whose bigotry it is. Bigotry is bigotry. Okay? So this is where we tend to think, well, okay, I may have bigotry, but my kind is okay because their kind is really horrible. But I'm bigoted against them and they're horrible people, so my bigotry is okay. But then other people are going to look at us and say, you're a hypocrite. You're talking about everybody being equal in wanting happiness and not wanting suffering, and everybody being equal and having the Buddha potential. But look how, prejudiced you are. You're not white supremacist, you're Buddhist supremacist. Yeah? And other people would criticize us for that, and they'd be right. Okay? So you see, this is how our mind works, is we always find a way to justify our beliefs and our feelings as somehow superior to other people's beliefs and feelings and actions. Yeah. I was in Israel, I don't know, it was a long time ago, and one Israeli man was driving me around, and we were talking about, I think it was the Six-Day War and what happened. And actually, the conversation started because There's one Buddhist monk who was an Israeli soldier during the war and is deaf because one of the missiles or whatever exploded quite near one of his ears, so that ear is deaf. So we started talking about that and then got into the war. And then that man said, you know, but we are morally superior to the Palestinians, you know, at which point I exploded. Okay. I said, how can you say that? Yeah. If you're going and killing other people, how can you say you are morally superior? That's a total oxymoron. Mm-hmm. And I said, you know, those people want their freedom and their integrity just as much as the Jews wanted their freedom and their integrity during the Second World War. Yeah, when they were put in concentration camps. So how can you say one side is morally superior if they're not respecting the rights of the other side? Okay. But this is how our human mind works. And, you know, when they train soldiers in the army, this is how they train you. The other people are morally inferior. Yeah. And you you call them names. You have slang names that you call them to deprecate them. And you talk about, you know, how they're wrong, and you never see any of the goodness or kindness in them at all. Yeah, which is totally distorted, because if you meet them in a different circumstance, even in this life, you could have a totally different relationship. There's one story in Don't Believe Everything You Think about, it was told by one American soldier who was guarding a Vietnamese POW, you know, about that man taking out pictures of his family and showing the American soldier. And, you know, and then he realized, you know, it's like, hey, we're both in the same boat. We're both traumatized by this war. Neither of us want to be in this war fighting other people. Yeah. So I think, you know, that's how it's best that we see this kind of thing. Yeah. Okay. So I've always had the idea that extremists of all sorts, they could have a conference together, and terrorists of all sorts could have a conference together, because they all have the same way of thinking. It's just they think that way about different groups of people or for different political causes. But if they had a conference on the best way to terrorize people, they could share so many ideas together because they think alike. Yeah, it's true, isn't it? So we have to be careful we don't become like that, because it's so tempting. We always like to be better, superior, blameless. And as long as we have afflictions in our mind, yeah, we have to have some humility. Because if we don't have humility, those afflictions are going to roar behind us and take over. Then we'll be in real big trouble, and we'll cause a lot of pain to other people as well. So I wanted to finish up chapter 3 and talk about Gyaltsen Jay's verse at the end. So here's Gyaltsen Jay's summarizing verse of chapter 3. Okay. So he says, those who understand they have attained a human birth, human rebirth, with freedoms and endowments, should strive in generating the two bodhicittas. Okay, two bodhicittas, conventional bodhicitta, the aspiration to become fully awakened for the benefit of sentient beings, and ultimate bodhicitta, the wisdom realizing emptiness. Okay, should strive in generating the two bodhicittas, the essential meaning of the teaching of the conquerors, the conquerors being the Buddhas, because they've conquered all their afflictions and defilements. Okay. The soul path traversed by the tens of millions of their children, the children of the conquerors being the bodhisattvas. So here we remember, you know, he's calling our attention to, you have a precious human rebirth with freedoms and fortunes. So use it wisely. Don't use it to generate afflictions and, you know, build your ego up and torment others who disagree with you. Yeah. But instead, put your energy towards generating the two bodhicittas, which is the essential meaning of all the teachings of the Buddha. So, you know, the Buddha's taught so many teachings. There's so many sutras, you know, and tantras. And if you want just the essential meaning, it's those two bodhicittas. Okay, so that's what we should focus on. Yeah. And those two bodhicittas are the soul path traversed by tens of millions of bodhisattvas. So we are not alone in this endeavor. Yeah. And the endeavor is not impossible, because tens of millions of trillions of zillions of sentient beings have already traversed it and become Buddhas. Okay, so we should have confidence in ourselves, confidence in the path, confidence in the goal of the path, and go forward while we have this brief window of opportunity in our beginningless samsara. Okay? So this is a good thing to remember when your mind starts getting picky about small things of this life. Yeah? When your mind starts going, well, why does somebody else get to do this and I can't? Or why is somebody else, they don't have to do it, but I do? Or why do they get more Brussels sprouts and I have to get the mashed potatoes? Or, you know, the innumerable things that we get picky about and how we waste our time. Yeah, it's amazing. So it's good to think about what Gyaltsev Jay is telling us in this verse. When we notice that our mind is, you know, getting really agitated and going around and around and around and around in circles of, you know, we were supposed to do this at this time and now they changed the time and, oh, I can't stand this changing the schedule all the time. And I just picked knapweed from this patch and now there's more knapweed growing there. Why doesn't the knapweed just go away? Okay. So, I'm using stupid examples, but we get bummed out by those. And think of the other examples that we get bummed out by. Yeah? And what we criticize. Yeah. They said the teachings are going to be at this time, but now they're late in the evening and I'm too tired. And why don't they make the teachings at a time that's convenient for me? Because I want to practice the Dharma and they make practicing the Dharma too hard because the teachings are too late when I'm too tired. Yeah? So, I mean, doesn't matter, big or small, it's the same kind of mind, isn't it? Okay. So now to go through the review of the outline of chapter 3. This acts as a good summary for us to remember what we learned in that chapter. Okay, so first there's this chapter is divided into the preparation, the actual, and the conclusion. So the preparation is to prepare to generate bodhicitta and take the ethical restraints of engaging bodhicitta. Okay, the reason I try to use the term ethical restraints as often as possible, but sometimes I forget, rather than vow, because the translation of the Sanskrit word means ethical restraints. Yeah, and that has a different flavor in English rather than vow. When we hear vow, we think of Catholic vows, don't we? Or marital vows. But a vow in which we promise never, ever, ever to do something, and if we do it, we go to hell. Okay? So that's kind of often the implication or the feeling that we get when we hear the word vow. When we hear ethical restraint, well, ethical, yes, I want to be ethical. And it means I have to restrain myself from certain activities. Okay, so we take precepts or we have individual ethical restraints within the big ethical restraint that help us do what we've decided we want to do. Okay, so in the preparation, first we rejoice in virtue. So there was a big section about rejoicing in virtue, because rejoicing, remember in the chapter 2, we did prostrations and offering. So now we're going on with the seven limb prayer. So rejoicing in the virtues that cause higher status, in other words, fortunate rebirths in the virtues that are the causes of liberation from cyclic existence, and the virtues that are the causes of the highest awakening. Okay? So rejoicing in all those virtues created by others and ourselves. But it's very, it brings such a happy, hopeful mind when we think of the virtues of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and the virtues of other sentient beings, because it reminds us that everything is not the front page of the paper. Okay? Yeah, that's not what everything that's going on in the world. Okay, then there was the verse requesting to turn the wheel of Dharma, which is so important, so that we really appreciate the teachings. The verse requesting the Buddhas and our teachers not to enter parinirvana, because if they do, then we're really lost. We don't have that guidance. And then the last of the seven, then, which is the dedication verses. Okay, dedication verses are another type of generosity, because usually when we practice generosity, we're offering material things, or we offer love, we offer protection. Here, we're offering our virtue by dedicating it for the awakening of ourself and others. Okay, so it's generosity, giving away our virtue instead of being attached to it, instead of being proud of it. Yeah. Rejoicing in it and sharing it. Okay, so I think I've told you this story when I first went to Singapore. And you know, this is actually how my writing began, is when I first went to Singapore, this young man came to see me and he was asking me all these questions, Dharma questions. And then other people, when I started giving talks, asked the same questions. And I was getting the same questions again and again. And I was thinking, wow, you know, people need some help here. And then one man came to see me and he said, if you ever want to write a book for free distribution, tell me and I will support in it. You know, I will make the offering to make that happen. So I got the idea to write a book of questions and answers. So it was first published as this thin booklet called I Wonder Why, and it later became bigger and became Buddhism for Beginners. Okay. But this man, you know, and he benefited it, and then he wanted to learn more meditation. So I spent some time teaching him meditation. And at the end of, I think it was even our first time meditating together, I said, let's dedicate the merit and, you know, imagine it radiating out and touching all sentient beings. And he looked at me with these eyes of like fear, and he said, I have so little merit, I don't want to give it away. Yeah, and he was so sincere because he really valued merit, he valued karma and its effects. But he didn't realize that the more you share it, the more you accumulate. He thought the more you shared it, the less you have. So I had to explain to him that when you rejoice and you dedicate your merit, then it increases. And that kind of relaxed his mind so that he could do the dedication at the end of the meditation session. But he was really, truly terrified, you know. And you can see on one hand, it was really based on a very strong belief in karma and its effects and respect for virtue. But he didn't realize how dedication is a practice of generosity and how generosity increases what you have when you give. We usually feel, you know, if I give something, then I don't have it. Yeah. Whereas it's really, if I give it, then it creates more, you know. Also material-wise, yeah, if we are a generous person giving material and so on, it comes back to us. Okay. So there's the general dedication, the dedication for the sick, the dedication to alleviate hunger and thirst, the dedication for the fulfillment of all wishes. So here we get a whole variety of things to dedicate for. And then as an auxiliary, you know, the perfection of generosity, because we may wonder when we look at engaging in the bodhisattva deeds, there's a chapter on almost every perfection, but not generosity. Okay, well, there is a chapter on the other five perfections, but not one on generosity. Well, here it comes here in chapter 3, and it also comes in chapter 10 when we're dedicating. Okay, but here it's really emphasized. So training in the thought of giving away our body. Our body, our possessions, and our root of virtue. So it starts with training in the thought of giving away our, so talking about the way of giving, the reasons why we should give. Okay, so by giving up attachment for everything and offering it, we go beyond misery. Now, do we really believe that? When it comes to giving up something we're attached to, do we really believe that giving it creates the cause for us to go beyond the misery of samsara? Do we really believe it? Or do we kind of harbor the good stuff and then give what we don't want or don't need or what is falling apart to others. Okay. I say as the virtue, the zipper on one of my, on the jacket I've been wearing is broken. And so, I want to offer it, see if anybody else in the community needs it. Actually, I think I'll cut it up and use it as rags and offer that to the community. But it's a new thing. It's new. But this mind that thinks, okay, I'll give up what is broken, what is useless. Yeah. But I just heard that somebody put some chocolate in my box. I will keep that. Okay. Okay, so, and then making offering to sentient beings is appropriate as they're the supreme field for generosity. Okay, so, here, Shanti Deva is really, he's trying to convince us on the benefits of being generous, trying somehow to break through our miserliness and our stinginess. Okay. But then we're going to look at this and say, okay, giving to sentient beings is appropriate, but there's the supreme field of generosity. No, the Lamrim says our guru is the supreme field of generosity. The Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are the supreme field of generosity. So I want to give to the holy beings, but sentient beings, they're just like me. They don't have any virtue. How are they the field of generosity? Okay. So again, I remember so well being at one Dharma center where we were all trying to elbow each other out so we could go wash the dishes of our teacher. Like Ling Rinpoche came to be at the center, Sekhum Rinpoche came to be at the center, let's elbow out everybody else. I want to go and all wash their dishes, all sweep their room. But they actually needed people to wash dishes for all the participants in the course. But none of us wanted to do that. Okay. So it shows how stupid we are. To put it bluntly. Okay. So yes, the holy beings are a field of merit, but sentient beings are a field of merit too. And especially, sentient beings who are practicing the path, sentient beings who are suffering, who are ill, who are impoverished. Okay. So it's important that we are generous towards those sentient beings. So how to practice after giving the offering? So from today on, I will give up the idea of having freedom over my body. What? What? Yeah, of course I have freedom over my body. Nobody's going to tell me what to do. Okay. What this is referring to is we're offering our body to sentient beings. So then somebody's going to say, you mean they can abuse me? They can cut off my head? They can do all this horrible stuff to me? I'm offering my body to them? That's craziness. I'm making myself a victim. Okay. No, that's not what Shanti Deva is encouraging. Okay. He means here, that we are offering our body to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. We are offering our life and our life energy to the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, which means that from now on, we will do our best to practice the Dharma and use our body for virtue, not for non-virtue. Okay? So, it means, that I'm going to stop fussing over my body. Yeah, keep it clean, keep it healthy. That's important. But I'm not going to sit there and try and decorate it with beautiful things and, you know, worry about how I look and, you know, try and make my body supremely comfortable at all times, because that is something non-existent, is supreme comfort of a defiled body. Yeah. So when we talk about existent and non-existent thing, you know, yeah, non-existent is a completely comfortable body. Yeah. Doesn't exist, does it? Because as long as, you know, all you have to do is wait a minute or two and your body will become uncomfortable for some other reason. Okay. Or the body becomes sick or something happens to it. So it's really, this is a method to help us to give up attachment to our body and to give up fear over what happens to our body. Yeah. Because, you know, we go to the doctor for tests and then it, you know, the tests come back and, you know, something's wrong and we like go, we freeze, you know, we just panic. And it's like, relax. Yeah. I gave my body away. I've dedicated it to do virtue. As long as I make my life meaningful by practicing however long I have this body, that's good. And when it's time to give it up, I give it up and I will pray to have another rebirth where I can continue practicing. Yeah. And if I can inject something here, so much when you go for different tests, they may be testing for one thing, but when they test for that one thing, there's other things that show up that they weren't looking at or weren't looking for that are abnormal. And so then they want you to have another test for this and another test for that, which aren't the things that they were initially testing for, which you also have to have more tests for. But then you have another test for that thing that they discovered that they weren't looking for. And then that leads to another test and another test. And then you're going back in there for more and more tests that are finding more and more things that they weren't looking for. So I'm not saying to ignore this, because sometimes they can find things that are, you know, need to be dealt with that we didn't notice before. Okay. But my brother, who's a doctor, taught me this acronym, okay, which I'm sharing for you. This is not Dharma, but it's a good acronym for when you have this kind of situation happen to you. The acronym is VOMIT, and it is Victim of Medical Imaging Technology. Okay? Where you, I just cracked up laughing when he told me this, you know, because that's exactly what it is. You get stuck in this rat race of having gazillions of tests. Yeah. Anyway, I'm not saying ignore those follow-ups. You know, some of them are important. You need to do that. But don't, what I am saying is don't get so petrified when you have a test for one thing and then there's, you know, two or other three other things they weren't looking for that now they think you may have something wrong. Don't freeze and get paranoid and go into, I'm going to die on Tuesday because of this. Okay. Which is what we happen to, you know, what happens, isn't it? Yeah. Okay. So then, dedicating to be this, So dedicating to be the source of inexhaustible virtue. So here, again, before we take the bodhisattva ethical restraints, yeah, We dedicate or practice generosity to be only the cause of the welfare of others and to never harm them, to dedicate the thought as the cause for inexhaustibility, so may my ability to benefit for others be inexhaustible, may my ability to act for the benefit of others be inexhaustible. And then dedicating to be the cause of an enjoyment, so then may we become whatever other sentient beings need. So this is like really relating to the taking and giving practice, where we imagine our body virtues and merit transforming into what other sentient beings need, you know. So your body transforms maybe into people that, you know, somebody needs a friend, you become a friend for that person. Somebody needs a washing machine, your body, your possessions transform into a washing machine. Okay, so you think like that, and then, and then dedicating to be able to do this in all times in a very expansive way and uninterruptedly. So there, that's when we got into that whole thing of making all these very beautiful aspirations. Yeah, that's so... opened our heart and gave us a vision of what bodhisattvas do and made us, you know, really feel hopeful and inspired. Okay. Then the actual part was generating bodhicitta, taking the aspiring bodhicitta, and then taking the ethical restraints of engaging bodhicitta. Okay, so we did that, yeah, with those two verses. Then after that, we rejoice again. This time we rejoice because we have achieved our own purpose of putting ourselves on the path to awakening and developing that. When we talk about the four Buddha bodies, the four kayas, the nature body and the wisdom dharmakaya, these are fulfilling our own purpose, because at that point we become the best kind of person we can become. And then generating the two form bodies, the enjoyment body and the emanation body, then that fulfills the purpose of other sentient beings, because at that time we're able to manifest these different forms to go out and teach and lead sentient beings. Okay, so we achieve our own purpose by generating bodhicitta. So generating bodhicitta isn't just, you know, I forget about myself and work for the purpose of others. It's, I have a purpose for myself, a goal, a meaning for myself to become the best kind of living being I can, and generating bodhicitta helps me to do that. Okay, and so we rejoice at that. We meditate on conscientiousness, having generated bodhicitta, so we make a strong determination not to relinquish it. And we rejoice again because we created this kind of aspiration that is, you know, so rare in samsara. And somehow, you know, it's almost miraculous we managed to generate this mind, because we managed, again, somehow almost miraculously, to encounter the teachings and the teachers at a time when our mind was open to take it all in. Okay, then we rejoice at achieving the purpose of others, because bodhicitta eliminates mental suffering. It can destroy the lord of death. It destroys poverty, sickness, the suffering of samsara in general, because as we practice the bodhicitta, it affects other living beings in a positive way and enables their lives to be better. And it specifically even destroys the lower realms, the unfortunate rebirths, because with bodhicitta, we, have good rebirths where we can spend more time being of benefit to other sentient beings. Okay, bodhicitta eliminates the cause of samsara, all of our obscurations, so it helps us eliminate the afflictive obscurations, the cognitive obscurations, and it helps us bring about all benefit and happiness for others and for ourselves. So we really rejoice because our lives have become really meaningful when we generate bodhicitta. Okay, so that was a long review and a long introduction, but I think it's helpful. Okay, now we get into the chapter on conscientiousness. Okay. So this is chapter 4. First, let's have a couple of definitions of conscientiousness. So here's what Asanga says in his text, The Compendium of Knowledge. Okay. So what is conscientiousness? It is an awareness that while abiding with enthusiasm within non-attachment, non-anger, and non-ignorance, protects one's meditation on virtue and protects the mind from contaminated phenomena. It has the function of being the basis for perfectly accomplishing and completing all ordinary and transcendental perfections. So let's look at that definition, okay? So it's an awareness, it's a mind. So the background of that mind is we're abiding with enthusiasm, yeah, within a mental state that is non-attachment, which is not just the opposite of attachment, it's not just the lack of attachment, it's the opposite of attachment. So a mind that is going towards generosity and giving, okay, it abides with that mind. A mind of non-anger, which again is not just the absence of anger, it's a mind of love. And non-ignorance, which isn't just the absence of ignorance, it's the wisdom of karma and its effects, and some of the wisdom of emptiness. Okay, so that's the background for the state of conscientiousness, and it protects our meditation on virtue and protects the mind from contaminated phenomena. So contaminated or polluted phenomena are the afflictions and non-virtuous actions. And so when we practice conscientiousness, yeah, this is like the, because this is the chapter on ethical conduct, you know, or ethical discipline. It really helps us to keep our ethical discipline, which is the mind that, refrains from any harmful act, any harmful attitude towards other sentient beings, and that helps us abandon any kind of harmful action towards other sentient beings. Okay, so that it has the function of being the basis for perfectly accomplishing and completing all ordinary and transcendental perfections. In other words, if we want to practice the other perfections as an ordinary being or as an Arya, we need the basis of ethical conduct. Okay? So without that basis of ethical conduct, how are we going to practice all the other perfections? Because if we involve our life in all sorts of negative thoughts, all sorts of discrimination, all kinds of animosity, all kinds of greed, and stirring up hostility and so on. How are we going to practice fortitude, joyous effort, concentration, wisdom, generosity? We can't practice anything else because our mind is totally involved in negativity. Okay? So we can see whether we're practicing the fundamental vehicle, we need the ethical restraints of the Pratimoksha, which involves the five precepts and the monastic precepts, and the eight one-day precepts. If we're practicing the Bodhisattva vehicle, we need the ethical restraints of engaging bodhicitta. If we're practicing the tantric vehicle, we need the ethical restraints of Vajrayana. So all of that depends on taking different sets of ethical restraints. Yeah. Because if we don't restrain our mind and our actions from negativity, how in the world are we going to create virtue? Yeah, we can't. Okay, so this is something really to think about because in America, you know, maybe in Europe too, I don't know about other cultures so much, but we think, oh, ethical conduct, that's morality. That means going to Sunday school and being told that you're going to hell if you don't share your toys with your brother or sister. And I'm so tired of being threatened with going to hell that I'm sick of all this kind of Sunday school stuff and forget it. Yeah? But that's not what the practice of ethical discipline is about in Buddhism. Okay? It's not Sunday school threatening us with punishment, God sending us to the hell realm if we're naughty kids. Yeah? We have to see how ethical conduct benefits us first and by extension benefits sentient beings. Because if we practice ethical conduct, our own mind is more peaceful. Okay? We have less guilt, less self-recrimination. We have more self-esteem. Okay, we have more self-confidence. We trust ourselves more. Okay, so really think about this and watch your own mind and find how the practice of ethical restraint really builds your self-esteem and your self-confidence and removes guilt and self-recrimination and feeling, you know, this feeling of, I hope other people don't know what's really going on in my mind because then nobody will like me. Okay. And if you keep ethical conduct, then also it removes shame because we realize, you know, we're not defective goods from the beginning. Okay. And we have integrity and we can keep that integrity. We can act, in ways that benefit ourselves, in ways that benefit others, in ways that create peace amongst people and harmony, okay? So all of that comes about on the basis of conscientiousness. Okay, here's another definition of conscientiousness. This one is from Gachen Yeshe Gelfand. And he says, conscientiousness is an awareness not under the control of the afflictions. Okay, so your mind is free from afflictions. That's good news to start with. While abiding in enthusiastic effort towards remaining free from the afflictions. So, wow, my mind doesn't have afflictions in it. And I have enthusiastic effort to keep my mind free of afflictions. You know, I'm not going to let my mind degenerate into all this petty rubbish that occupies it. And all the fear, all the anxiety, all the despair. Okay, I'm not going to let my mind degenerate into that. Okay. And it functions to protect the mind from polluted phenomena, the afflictions, and to accomplish virtue. Okay. So that's talking about what conscientiousness is. So now, finally, we'll start reading from chapter 4. 1. Having firmly seized the bodhicitta in this way, bodhisattvas must never waver. Always should they exert themselves to never stray from their practice. Yeah? So it's saying that having generated the bodhicitta and taken the bodhisattva ethical restraints, we must not doubt what we just did. We must not waver from our intention to be of long-term benefit to all sentient beings by attaining awakening. Yeah. And we should exert ourselves, you know, to never stray from that practice. So keep our minds focused on bodhicitta and don't let that mind of doubt sneak in. Because that mind of doubt says, well, yeah, I took the bodhisattva ethical restraints, but it was really it was an emotional feeling, an exhilarating feeling. And now I look at what I promised to do and like, there's no way I can do that. Anyway, becoming a Buddha is way too hard for me. The path is way too difficult. I don't want to give up my body. Yeah. I don't want to even keep the pratimoksha restraints because I want to, you know, I want to go to the disco and I want to go to the pub, you know, because if I go to the bar, that's where I meet people, you know, and I want to go on, what is it, Cupid and all these dating applications. You know, I want to do that, and I want to look up all these things, yeah? I want to research who the Proud Boys are, you know, get to know everything about them. And I want to really research the Antifa and get to know everything about them. You know, so some knowledge of these things is needed, but we don't need to know everything about them, okay? Because the danger is that then we start thinking, oh, maybe what they're saying is right. And there's an awful lot of people who say that, you know. And Proud Boys, I want to be a Proud Boy. Yeah. Actually, that group is misogynistic. I want to start the Proud Girls. Yeah. Yeah. But Trump didn't say anything about them. He only supported the Proud Boys. He didn't support the Proud Girls. Yeah, see? Typical. Okay, so we make the determination not to stray from that, not to let that mind of doubt come in. So we need to be prepared for when that mind of doubt comes. Yeah. If we think, oh, I've decided to do this, I will never doubt it. Yeah, we aren't necessarily so in touch with the potential of our afflictions to dominate the mind. Okay, especially the affliction of doubt. Yeah. So what do we think when we start doubting the goal of awakening and saying, it's totally unrealistic. I can't benefit all sentient beings. It's too hard. It's too high. I just want to get myself out of samsara. That's hard enough. Yeah, who wants to spend 3 countless great eons, and for me it'll probably take even longer, to attain Buddhahood when I can attain liberation in a much shorter period of time? So what are you going to do when that mind arises? Tell me, what are you going to do? Yeah, meditate on the disadvantages of self-centeredness. That's a good one. What else? And the advantages of cherishing others.
How about compassion?
Yeah.
You have the suffering of everybody.
Yeah.
Not just you.
Yeah, so having compassion, not just for ourselves, but for everybody. And that is based on having equanimity. Okay. Yeah. Okay, meditating on the kindness of others and wanting to repay that. How about remembering that the Buddha was once an ordinary being like us? And, you know, we used to go to the beach with the Buddha. And lie out on the beach, you know, in a previous eon when there was no pandemic. And we lied out on the beach, not with the Buddha, but with the previous sentient being in the continuum of the Buddha. Yeah. But then that previous continuum started practicing the Dharma and we kept laying on the beach. So the Buddha became awakened. And we're still on the beach, okay? We're still in samsara. So to remember that it's actually possible to attain full awakening, that the Buddha did it, that, you know, millions of billions of zillions of other living beings have done it, okay? What, if we start doubting the path, so that was doubting the result. If we start doubting the path, the path is too hard. I have to give up my body. I don't want to give up my body. I don't want to give up my merit. I don't want to give up my possessions. I work so hard. My family, you know, was impoverished, and I was the first generation to get an education, and now I'm pulling my family out of poverty, and so I don't want to give up my possessions. Yeah. So what do you do if that mind comes up and you start doubting bodhicitta? Because you doubt the path, you know, whether you can do the path. And also you doubt whether the path really brings that result. How does giving up my body bring the result of awakening? It doesn't. It just makes me miserable. How does giving up my possessions bring the result of awakening? It doesn't, you know, it just makes me more and more unhappy. And when I'm unhappy, I can't benefit anybody. So how are you going to, what are you going to think about if that kind of doubt comes in your mind? Okay, the first two noble truths and the faults of cyclic existence. How does that counteract that doubt?
Well, it sounds like you're not willing to give something up because you think there's some happiness in it. So if you're really seeing the faults, the actual experience of cyclic existence, that will counter that unreasonable attachment.
Yeah. Okay.
Meditate on the dependent arising because it's all about creating the causes. It's not so hard. You don't have to like create the entire path. You just have to focus on the right causes for the right goal.
Yeah. Just take one step at a time and create the causes. Yeah.
To remind myself of the times when I followed attachment and how miserable that makes me, and then to remind myself when I do put the little Dhamma that I can into practice, what relief that brings.
Yeah.
So then encourage myself that just keep going in that direction.
Yeah. So to remember how our previous attachment has made us so sunk in suffering. Yeah. We need to remember that. Yeah. We usually forget it when attachment arises. And same with anger. Yeah. We forget how miserable anger makes us. But it does. And we need to remember that.
Linda said, look back the past 5 years. How much improvement in your own mind from whatever effort you have. The Dharma is so powerful. So to look back and go, okay, well, what has happened since I met the Dharma?
Yeah.
And to really see the improvement and the clarity and the good qualities that are arising. So yeah. Put it in context, put it in a bigger perspective than right now.
Yeah. So that actually falls within when we doubt ourselves and our ability to practice. So that's doubting the basis, ourself. But that's exactly the antidote, to see that we have improved and we have changed. And so to not just despair and say, you know, I'm hopeless.
That karma functions. I mean, law of the dependent arising is to see the creation of the causes if we want something different.
Yeah. That we have the potential to actually create the cause.
The causes.
And we can experience the result, some of it even in this life.
We are facing limitless future lives, and we can choose to face them by being stuck in samsara, or we can choose to put that time to work for the maximum benefit, which is attaining Buddhahood, one lifetime at a time.
Right, and actually getting ourselves out of samsara. Yeah. Okay. So, we finished one verse. Other questions? We have a little bit of time for Q&A.
A comment, Venerable, that just kind of blew right up to the top of my mind here, is when you said, you know, keeping our minds on bodhicitta, not let doubt sneak in, and you went through this whole little situation. I think it's this mind that says, I want a life. And for whatever reason, we think that if we're going to generate bodhicitta, we have to give up our life. The joys, the pleasures, the inspiration. Mm-hmm. I want a life, and bodhicitta is not going to give it to me. I have to give something up in a, just, you know, we're looking at the happiness of just this life.
Right.
That really.
And what we don't realize is what we do have to give something up. What we're giving up are the causes of dukkha. What we're renouncing is dukkha, misery, suffering, and all of its causes. We're not renouncing happiness. Okay? And that's very important to remember, because we hear renunciation and we think, I have to give up my chocolate. That's impossible. But that's not what we're being asked to do. We're being asked to give up our attachment. And if we're smart, we can see how our attachment causes us misery and makes us create the cause for more misery.